Hello, I'm Brett Dillon, and this is The Movie Chronicles. This episode, we take on the continent-island of Australia. We begin with a movie that was based on a crime that was a copycat crime shown in the movie Dirty Harry, 1971. And let's not forget the Lord of the Flies vibe. The movie is Fortress. Director, Arch Nicholson. Script, Everett D. Roach. Director of Photography, David Connell. Editor, Ralph Strasser. Music, Danny Beckerman. Actors, Sean Garlick, Rachel Ward, Mark Aidan Gray, Rebecca Rigg, Asher Keddie, Vernon Wells, and Terence Donovan. Yeah, nah. Fortress is about these munters who kidnap some kids for a ransom. But no working furries, mate. The kids go all nuclear holocaust. Critics commented that the film goes all Lord of the Flies. The epilogue suggests something much worse happened. More like Silence of the Lambs. As you would expect, the film starts slowly with a depiction of the daily grind. Sally Jones is the local schoolteacher, billeted with a farming family. We are taken through everyone's routine, including one of the sons shooting a fox that tried to sneak into the henhouse. He is ordered to skin it before breakfast. The children, with Sally, walk to the school, where we become aware of the dead things in the area, and the school children's superstitions around them. As the lessons begin, one of the children notices cartoon characters hanging around outside. These are men in masks. I'll stick with the Internet Movie Database naming convention. They are Santa Claus, Daffy Duck, Pussycat, and Mac the Mouse. They're up to no good. They have a plan to kidnap the children for a ransom. They've either been watching too many Italian movies or come up with a scheme during a wacky-backy session. While the film shows they've gone to great lengths to plot and prepare the scheme, there's no sign they've even noticed how dumb the entire scheme is. Not the least of my concerns is that this farming community is not shown as being wealthy in anything other than land, which is a non-transportable item. Leader of this group is Santa Claus, also probably the most criminally adept of the group, and with a vicious streak about a mile wide. This foursome burst into the school and take control. Teacher and pupils are bundled into a van. This takes them to a cave deep in the mountain area where they are sealed inside. This turns out to be a tunnel system with another escape point, which this party use. This takes them to a farmhouse, where the gang are waiting. This group's arrival causes the gang to murder the farmer and his wife, which also means by implication they need to kill the children and the teacher, which you would think they'd do straight away and cut the film short. The school escapes and returns to the cave system. They fortify the area and prepare booby traps over the night. A fight for survival begins that is red in both tooth and claw, and, I might add, anticlimactic. I can see what director Arch Nicholson was trying to do. His problem is that the villains are defeated far too easily. The epilogue takes us back to the school. The police want to question the teacher. The bodies have been found near the cave system, just as the children recounted. They even find the mutilated body of Santa Claus. The problem is that these are very strange mutilations that an animal could not possibly have done. The teacher says she knows nothing about this as the camera slowly pans to glass jars on the windowsill holding organs that may or may not be human in origin. The novel Fortress was written by Gabrielle Lord, who was inspired by the 1972 Faraday School kidnapping and William Golding's 1954 novel Lord of the Flies. although Gabriel seems to have gotten the wrong message from that novel. The Faraday incident started with Edwin Eastwood and Robert Boland entering the one-teacher school at Faraday, kidnapping the teacher and six pupils, and demanding a $1 million ransom. The victims escaped, and the kidnappers were captured. Edwin escaped and repeated the crime, this time taking a teacher and nine pupils, and had just as much luck. He was sent to prison for 15 years for the first crime and 25 years for the second, with a non-parole period of 22 years. He then murdered convicted rapist Glenn Davies while in jail. He was paroled in 1990 and back in prison soon after. Robert was convicted and served 11 years of his 15-year sentence. Actor Rachel Ward was born on September the 12th, 1957, in Cornwall, England. Rachel left the Byamshaw School of Art to become a fashion model. She moved to the USA in 1977 and started to make waves with her appearance in Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid in 1982. However, it was the TV miniseries The Thornbirds, 1983, that held her breakout performance. Rachel married Australian actor Brian Brown in 1983 and disappeared for 2 years after making Fortress, 1985, to study acting. She returned to the screen with Hotel Colonial, 1987. History would harp on and on, on. February the 5th. Australia cancelled its involvement in the US-led MX missile tests. I'm guessing, based on recent history, that Australia was afraid the US would allow the weapon to fall into civilian hands. March the 18th. The soap opera Neighbours debuted on Australia's Seven Network. April the 28th. Although gaining support in the 1984 general election, Australia's nuclear disarmament party imploded over accusations some members are Trotskyists associated with the Socialist Workers' Party. I'm still having trouble parsing why this is so bad if it is known about. I can only believe the party thought it couldn't control for this fact. September the 20th. A capital gains tax was introduced in Australia. As rich people still live in Australia, there seems to have been no downstream ill effects. New Zealand politicians, take note. Let's trudge across the desert with a film that asks the burning question. What can a didgeridoo? Burke and Wills, director Graham Clifford, script Michael Thomas, director of photography Russell Boyd, and editor Tim Welburn, music Peter Sculthorpe, actors Jack Thompson, Nigel Havers, Greta Saatchi, Matthew Fagan, Ralph Cotterill, Chris Hayward, Hugh Keyes-Byrne, and Peter Collingwood. The Burke and Wills expedition was a doomed heroic endeavour to survey the interior of Australia. It's part of white Australian mythology. I'm happy to say that many aspects of the expedition, the nuances of the doom, get a mention in this film. The film focuses on the endeavour rather than the things that brought it to an unsatisfactory conclusion. All this might best be explained by the casting of Nigel Havers as Mr. Wills. Nigel plays the character as an audience identifier, the one explaining context to the audience and whom the audience are in sympathy with. He is a character without any character, which I admit is partly the fault of the script. Mr. Wills is very passive. He goes with the flow of things and has to play against Jack Thompson doing his best impersonation of Quint from Jaws as Mr. Burke. As an Australian film, it's a bit strange that we start in Pommyland for a prologue involving cricket and some backstory to Mr. Wills. We are at a garden party in England, 1854. The young Mr. Wills, from a stout upper-middle-class family, is looking for something to do with his life. He follows a young lady into a labyrinth, and we cut to a scene of the harsh Australian desert. We are being set up for Mr. Wills to become lost in the labyrinth that is the Australian outback. With this introduction over, we now move to Melbourne, Australia in 1860. Mr. Wills provides a voiceover narration to bring us up to date. The colonizers want to move inland to learn if there is anything they can steal stroke utilize to make themselves wealthier. One expedition has already set out, and Mr. Burke is heading another one hot on its heels. Mr. Wills is with this second expedition, funded by landowners seeking more land to exploit. Mr. Burke is a fiery Irishman, racist, and with little experience. He has the advantage of being a member of the constabulary and therefore has some experience in enforcing discipline. I'm also guessing he came cheap, despite the committee complaining about all the expense, which is a foreshadowing of what is to happen. Burke's expedition has the advantage of a camel train with sepoys to handle them. Even so, progress is slow enough that Mr. Burke can return to his mistress between the advances, or, as it were, make advances while advancing. While he's away, the sepoys finally acknowledge they have dietary demands, per religion, that are not being met. This industrial matter is left to Mr. Wills to fix. Narratively, this goes nowhere. Mr. Wills is passive. He never berates Mr. Burke for abandoning the expedition. It's more passive-aggressive in that, having ordered things to the workers' satisfaction, it's never mentioned again. I'm not sure how this plot element functions in the story. I think it means to show that Mr. Wills will travel a great distance to avoid conflict. The expedition now crosses the Murray River. The camels are cross at the crossing. They are now at the edge of the known world, or at least that part of it known to white people. As they keep travelling north, it becomes clear there is ill will between Mr. Burke and the third in command, Mr. Landell. Mr. Landell is a grouser, but to do him credit, he sees through Mr. Burke and realizes all the points on which this expedition will founder. There is first contact with the Aborigines, a race of thieves, in the opinion of Mr. Burke, and he will have none of them. They cross a desert and survive a sandstorm to reach a plain. At its edge is Cooper's Creek, the halfway point. With water here, they set up a food store stroke fort. This is where the party split in two. Half keep pushing towards the Gulf of Carpentia. The others are to wait for supplies to be forwarded from Melbourne. Unbeknownst to this party, the leader of the resupply team, Bill Wright, is refusing to move forward until he is paid. Closer to the money, he has noticed the money men want the glory of discovery, but don't care who dies to achieve it for them. The colonizers are refusing to pay, thus hanging out their expensive expedition to dry, and certainly showing the contempt Mr. Landell has observed they have for the men in the expedition. Cooper's Creek is an idyll. The men relax before the next big push. They even play cricket, watched from afar by a curious band of Aborigines. The advance team move on. To move along this narrative, after much suffering, they reach the Gulf. On the return trip, they lose a man. They arrive at base camp a day after the stayers have departed, forced by lack of supplies to return. Burke and Wills miss the message about the buried supplies. With no supplies, Burke insists they detour towards Hopeless Station. This kills their camel, and they lose all their water when it falls. Back in Melbourne, there are political ramifications when it is discovered the supplies were never sent because the colonizers refused to pay the workers. A rescue party is sent out. All they can find is the youngest member, John, who has returned to the base camp and is being cared for by the Aboriginal tribe. He is able to recount the deaths of Mr. Burke and Mr. Wills. The film is a widescreen experience. However, even in widescreen, it lacks something that would make the film an experience. We don't really immerse in the environments, and the characters are not engaging. It's hard to care about what happens to them. The Burke and Wills Expedition. The expedition, funded by the Royal Society of Australia, departed from Melbourne in 1860, with a complement of 19 men led by Robert O'Hara Burke and William John Wills. In June 1861, John King, the only survivor, returned to Melbourne. The purpose of the expedition was a scientific examination of the Australian interior, an area unknown to the white man. The board formed to oversee the experiment had two members with considerable experience in exploration, Ferdinand von Mueller and Wilhelm Blandowski. As they were only damn foreigners, their advice was ignored. Burke was chosen to lead the expedition, presumably because he had no bushcraft experience, and Wills was the surveyor, also because he had little experience. It was Burke's leadership that doomed the expedition. There is no one more dangerous than a man who poses as an expert on everything and knows nothing about it. Just ask former president and national embarrassment, Donald, I love the way the mafia works, Trump. Deaths knelled through the knoll. On. January the 11th. William McKell, former Governor General of Australia, born 1891. April the 17th. Evadne Price, the Australian author, born 1888. If the last film didn't get you animated, then I can guarantee this one will. Dot and the Koala. Director and script, Yoram Gross. Script, Greg Flynn. Director of photography, Graham Sharp. Editor, Ted Otten, Ian Spruce, and Neil Thumpston. Music, John Sangster and Bob Young. Actors, Robin Moore and Keith Scott. The Dot series takes an unusual turn in this second entry. In the first movie, Dot had to chew on a magic herb in order to speak to and understand the creatures. In this film, she just can. This would be a problem if not for the fact that all of the mythology of the previous film has been thrown away. The opening credit sequence contains laughter. This goes nowhere except to introduce us to an Australian town made of talking animals. Conservation of the bush is the theme of this film. Sharp-eyed viewers will note all the city creatures are introduced species. The mayor of this sleepy burg wants to introduce progress and is annoyed at his citizens. The laughter we were hearing in the credits was a pub audience. One of the locals has been recounting his run-in with a city fella. The city fella has a bee up his bum about progress. What's so good about progress? Asks the local. It allows you to do things, says the city fella. Like what? Asks the local. You'd have time to relax in the shade and drink a few beers, says the city fella. I'm doing that now, says the local. The key to progress is building a dam on the river. It's a damn good idea, says the posters, stuck over the post-no-bills posters. A bat descends from the skies and rips up the posters with the mark of Zorro. By now, the sharp-eyed will have noticed the character designs owe a potload, now that's a very Bakshi pun, to the work of Ralph Bakshi. As the mayor is calling a meeting, the forest creatures call a meeting of their own under that firebrand koala. The result of this meeting is a protest march into the town. They disrupt the mayor's meeting with a riot. This the mayor turns to his advantage by pointing out that with progress, they could build a better hospital and no one would have to wait for treatment, or tweetment if you're one of the birds. Although, in this woke era, I'm probably going to have to call it excrement. Despite the objections of over half his constituents, the mayor pushes his project through. While all the heavy machinery is arriving in time, we'll take a break from the narrative to observe that the film is a curious mix of live action and animation. In the first film, the backgrounds were live and the animation overlaid on the top. This film has a little of this technique, but also adds in live action animals on occasion. When the machinery arrives, the forest animals are forced from their homes. The animals protest by raiding the camp and attempting to sabotage the construction process. It's a farce that doesn't work. With over half the movie now shot through, the animals decide to contact Dot to see if she can come up with a plan. In a minor narrative, rat detective Sherlock Bones has been assigned security detail at the camp. He's keeping tabs on all the protesters. Dot has a plan so cunning, you could pin a tail on it and call it Sherlock Bones. The plan is to have wombats dig a hole under the dam. The weight of the dam will be supported by scaffolding stolen from the dam site, and at the right moment, the termites, perfectly vile Japanese caricatures, a big racist misstep of this film, will gnaw away the supports, sending the dam into the hole the wombats have built. Sherlock has all the wombats arrested. Dot uses their incarceration as a cover for the continuance of the operation. The town ends up being saved, but saved for progress or not, you will have to see the film to determine. I guess it's past time we dipped into some more films from the superhero genre, so that's what we'll do next. We go to 2005, and no spoilers, but I'll give you a clue.
I'm Batman.
For more Australian awesomeness, purchase any of the Movie Chronicles ebooks available from an e-store near you. Become a Patreon or Buzzsprout supporter to keep this show showing. And if you want something psychedelic, lick the button or whatever and give this show a rating. Bang this keyboard! Give this show a rating. We need more naval men on this show.